It said that there are 84,000 Dharma doors. I think that was true before population growth. Now there's probably 84 billion Dharma doors. There's a Dharma door for each of you, for every person. Every moment, there's a Dharma door for each of us. Part of the task is to see the door that we walk through, your Dharma door now. It's always here for you, waiting for you. When one of the biggest enterprises in the history of Buddhism was the importation and translation of Buddhism from India to China. And Chinese had a huge task to try to make sense of all the different sutras and literature. In India, the literature, sutras kind of developed slowly over time, so the Indians had some sense of it, but the Chinese kind of got all of it. And in about the 6th or 7th century, there was a famous Chinese philosopher, one of the most famous. And he had the benefit of reading all these translated texts and trying to make sense of all of it. And he made sense of it in a very pithy sentence. He has a huge book that he wrote. But in that book he said, liberation beckons us within everything. Everything that you encounter beckons you to be free, invites you. Come. Come here. You can be free. Isn't that quite a summary of it all? So 84 billion Dharma doors for you. When my children were younger, I started meeting a lot of other children. And I was surprised at the variation in children. Before they were properly socialized, maybe. There was a lot of variation. And there were some kids who, in schools where my kids were, who were autistic. That's how they were born. Some were dyslexic. Some had a variety of new conditions I never heard of. Some variation of being hypersensitive. Some of them were hypersensitive to sounds. It was painful sounds for them. And other kinds of heightened sensitivities that made being in the classroom hard. And I saw so many different kinds of children, and they're children. So. And I felt that all you could do, the thing that was left to do was to love them all. I mean, they were born this way. Perfect way to be born. If you love it, love them. My son was one of the dyslexic kids, and he were in a school which didn't have any, they didn't really push the reading thing, so there was no problems for him, it wasn't required to read. But my wife got a sense that something was not quite right. Before the teachers or anyone else noticed, or before he noticed anything. So So she kind of looked into it. And then early in that process, she read a book just a title was quite powerful, very helpful in this process. The book was called The Gift of Dyslexia. Isn't that nice? So when we introduced my son to the fact that he was dyslexic, because we had to work with him a little bit with it, it was introduced to him as if it was a gift. And the person who wrote the book had a dyslexia program on the peninsula near where we lived, so my son went to work there, and the person he worked with was dyslexic, the adult. And he was kind of like, here is a great guy. So not only was it a gift, but it was, he got to hang out with this great guy who had the same gift. Isn't that nice? And then I read some years ago a study, I think it was in The Economist. I don't know if that's any better than Wikipedia, but it was a study done of people who had attention deficit disorder. Because apparently in most societies, about 10% of the population have attention deficit disorder. And these scientists thought, well, if that many people have it, there's a few exceptions. So some apparently America has a little bit more. They think it has something to do with the people who immigrated here were kind of like a little bit hyped up in order to want to move and come here. So it's a little bit shifted the percentage a little bit maybe. But such a high percentage of the people have attention deficit, what we call it, a disorder, there must be a reason for it. So they studied it, and one of those things they studied was bush people, I think they're called that, in Africa. And what happened to they studied them and found out that sure enough, when they were living in their traditional way, 10% of them also had what we call attention deficit disorder, but they were quite happy, no problem, no disorder. But when they moved to the city, then things didn't work so well for them. So the theory of these researchers is that there was a time in traditional living, hunter-gatherer time or whatever, that what we call attention deficit disorder was an asset for the community. It was helpful that 10% of the population had this particular kind of mind. It was an important thing. People who could pick up things quickly, could scan the horizon, could be out in nature exploring, ready to explore and look. I've known people who have this so-called disorder, and they find themselves completely happy being forest rangers, park rangers. That's their mind works for that kind of setting, scanning the horizon, picking up things, always kind of looking, and something like that. And so we come to our modern world and we call it a disorder. Is it a disorder? Whose disorder is it? Is it society's disorder? Or is it the individual's disorder? Is it that our societies, is kind of, where does it, do we define ourselves by the conditions of our society? The doctors call it a disorder. Society doesn't quite work in society because we're expected to read a lot. At least we used to. Most of you here grew up in the and soon to be disappearing age of reading. Most of human life, people didn't read. And the way it's looking, it's going. If my kids are any indication of it, we're the last generation of readers, real readers. So there's so many different ways of being a person. And there's a Dharma door for you. Maybe you are perfect. Maybe the way you are, it's just fine. Maybe society needs you to be the way you are. Maybe you're the 10% of something that society needs to kind of have all the different variations, ways that people have to be. Society doesn't function well if, like growing crops. monoculture tends to be a very unstable way of growing crops. And you need a lot of pesticides and herbicides to make it work. So if we get to all be the same, I don't know what we want to be like. If we were all like, if the women were like, there's a woman named Kim, K something, Kashian, Kashian. She said, I'm sorry, I don't really know, but I saw the headlines. It's kind of like a big thing right now. And while you're here, she's exposing her breasts. You always seen that. That's what you're missing on the headlines. So I'm not quite sure who it is, but I guess I'm kind of out of it, right? But we could all be like her. Or then there's this Justin Bieber guy. He's also in the headlines. While you're here, he thinks you don't need to know. So we could all be kind of same. Or, you know, what if the everyone was the same and they were just like Paul and I? That would be a problem. There's a tendency for people to look towards, you know, spiritual teachers and kind of want to be like them. And, you know, I don't know why it is, but leave us alone. We're perfect ourselves, but don't try to. But we need all the variation of all the different kinds. And I think approaching it that way and appreciating that way is a very important part of life. So appreciating yourself for who you are and how you are. And this is important because all these Dharma doors, everything's a Dharma door, actually, everything you encounter. Everything you meet, everything you see and touch and taste and feel and think. Because the Dharma door is, there's always two things going on. There's what's happening and how you're relating to what's happening. And the freedom belongs to the world of how we relate to what's happening, not to what's happening. And so it's here in us. And relating, our relatingness, the way we relate, the way we meet something, meet the world, that belongs to our half of the equation. And so freedom is not about changing the world, but rather some kind of change in ourselves so we can meet the world in a wise way. We can meet the world in a free way, meet the world with ease. Or to say it in other ways, which maybe is more, in some ways might be a more profound way of saying it. Rather than saying meet it with freedom or ease or compassion, it's kind of a problem sometimes to have these ideals. There's a long tradition in Buddhism of saying it a different way, which I think is in some ways more caring. To meet the world without aversion, to meet it without greed, to meet it without delusion. And why it's more compassionate to say it that way, to say it in the negative, is that then we get to be who we are. The aversion drops away, the greed drops away, the attachments drop away, and then we can just be. But if we're supposed to meet it with liberation, compassion, I mean, it gets to be a headache kind of quickly. You know, living up to these things. It's hard to be yourself if you have these things you're supposed to be a certain way. But it's easier to be yourself if you kind of let all the extra stuff fall away. So here we are. And we're talking about the paramitas, the six paramitas. Generosity, virtue, today it's patience, effort or energy, concentration, and then wisdom. And these are all qualities that we have as much as practices that we engage in. And so one of the ways of listening to a talk like this is to listen to it as if you already know what's being talked about in some way. And if you can kind of listen to the talk, like we'll talk about patience, and see, is there some place in your history of your life, some corner of your psyche, your heart, or somewhere, where what I say about patience, yes, I know that. Some people are very good at hearing a talk and saying, yes, but. Yes, but. Patience. But when the Nazis come, are we supposed to be patient? So kind of going that direction. Wait a minute, you're kind of protesting almost. But it's actually more useful for you to not come up with the exceptions in the extreme situations or where it doesn't work. It's actually something very significant about looking, where is this actually true for you already? Where is it true for you already? It doesn't have to be true in all ways, and not everything I say has to be true, you know, some absolute way. But where is this useful for me? Where is this true already? And then once you kind of see it for yourself, is there some way that then you can build on that and grow that, expand it out so it's your own? But if you hear it in too big of a way, you have to be patient when the Nazis come. Then, you know, you probably shut down and, you know, it doesn't seem relevant then. So the word patience is, in Sanskrit, is kshanti. In Pali, it's kanti. And it's somewhat questionable whether it should be translated as patience. You know, it's hard to translate concepts from one culture to another, one language to another. Other terms that are used are forbearance, even endurance, acceptance. And interestingly, it also covers what we call in English forgiveness, to be forgiving. If you look for a Sanskrit or Buddhist word to translate forgiveness back into, you know, into Indian languages, you know, often they'll come up with kanti or kshanti as the translation. And there are, I think, it's useful to distinguish three different ways in which we practice patience. And within that, there's many ways. And the reason I want to say there's many ways, it has to do with all the different ways we are human beings. And not only are you different from everyone else and unique, but you're unique this moment. You're unique today, than different than how you were yesterday. And we go through phases, and we go through maturations and growth over time. And so different issues, different things come up at different times. And in different situations, the different aspects or different ways of practicing patience become relevant. So the way to organize it, I think, it might be nice, is by what's called the three trainings. There is a training in sila, ethics. There is a training in, the word is samadhi, but in inner cultivation, development, developing oneself internally. And then there's a training in wisdom or insight. And there is a tradition where ethics, one of the meanings of ethics in this three trainings, it has to do with restraint, the ethics of restraint. We don't give in to impulses that are going to cause harm. If you feel like killing your neighbor, you don't. You might accept your murderous rage in the stillness and safety of your meditation, but you restrain your actions. You don't you don't go kill anyone. You might feel like you want to lie to someone for some reason. And perhaps when you sit quietly, it's interesting, kind of open to that feeling and be with it and just let it be in a generous way. But you don't lie to your friend. You restrain yourself. You feel angry at someone and you would like to yell at them. But you don't. You restrain yourself. And I wish people would restrain themselves a little bit more often. It'd be more interesting. I'd find it more meaningful to read the newspapers if people did. There'd be more nicer things to read. Because a lot of the problems that beset people, the way people treat each other, are behaviors that probably would be better to if people had restrained from doing. And it's a kind of and for some people, and probably you in your life, there have probably been times where you wish you had restrained yourself, and times where you did, and times where you felt, I need to be really patient right now. I feel all this anger, I feel all this desire, I feel all this whatever. This is a very difficult situation I'm in, and I better not lash out. I better not act impulsively now. I better be patient. I better endure it. It's difficult. I better endure it. As opposed to some of the other things you can do. Be patient with what's there. There are times in my life where I remember once I spent a night, a whole night, not being able to sleep because the object of my desire, my inappropriate desire, had left her door open. And I was sleeping on the couch. And the door was open, you know, it's 84,000 doors, right? doors. It was not a door I should go through. It just was inappropriate. But my body didn't quite believe that. So I stayed up, I tossed and turned the whole night long, tempted. I could have, you know, I didn't accept my desire. And this is something I had to endure, I had to be patient with. I had to be patient, not give in, be patient, stay with it. To be patient. Our lives create a lot of momentum. One of the meanings of karma is we put in motion momentum. And I think all of you have experienced the consequences of your life's momentum coming here on the retreat. You come here, maybe you're tired, but you have emotions. Some of you have a backlog of emotions that haven't really been felt. And so finally they have a chance to come out. You have concerns, unresolved issues. And you might be busy or keeping them at bay. And as you slow down and as you open up, these things that have been held at bay or held away begin coming up. And that's the momentum. If you So what do we do with the momentum? One of the best things to do is to be patient with it. Some things just have to unwind on their own. Not struggle with it or fight it, but appreciate that, you know, that just before coming here to the retreat, you robbed your local bank, that, you know, there's a certain momentum that comes with you. And you have to now live with that momentum. Maybe that's a bad example. But maybe you did something that you're ashamed of. Something you harmed someone, you hurt someone. And I think we would do you a disservice if you came here to the retreat and we just said, just let go of everything. you harmed your best friend. You know, just let go of it. It's fine. Just accept it and just kind of be present. I think it's appropriate to let the momentum of karma continue, to really face that and be present for it and feel it and be with it. I think it's a very mature, kind of liberated thing to do, to be willing to accept the momentum of our karma, momentum of our past actions, the consequences of it. And so sometimes we have to have the wisdom to know this, what's happening now, this I have to live with. It could be something as simple as on retreat, as overeating at lunch. I've done that many times on retreat. And then I come to sit in the afternoon. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to be patient with this one. You know, bloated, tired. So I could fight it, I could get upset with it, I could try to develop my samadhi to override it. But I think there's actually something very appropriate. I did this thing, now I have to endure, I have to experience, I have to live with the consequences. And not give in to anger, not give in to self-criticism, not give in to escapism, whatever it might be. Just be here with it. So on the restraint side, the first training in ethics, it has a lot to do with not giving in to harmful tendencies, impulses that are going to cause harm to yourself or cause harm to others. The basic compassion of this practice is to try not to do things which cause harm. And I know for many people here in the West, self-criticism is a huge one. Some people can go to 0 to 60 with self-criticism in less than a second. It's such a strong habit. I'm doing it wrong. I'm bad. I shouldn't have done it that way. It's a way of harming. So sometimes ksanti, patience, involves restraining oneself from doing that. Not now. I'm not going to do that. I don't need to do that. Let's not do that now. No need to be critical here. Just be present. A big part in the tradition of what ksanti means is not to give in to anger. So here's a story, and I'll read a poem. One of the kings of a certain group of gods was Shakya. And these gods sometimes were at war with the Asuras. And Asuras are these kind of semi-deities, titans. Sometimes they're called titans, these semi-deities. I don't know where these live, but probably somewhere up higher than us. And the Asuras are jealous of the gods, because the gods have it really good. They have a lot of pleasure. Sometimes they're depicted in Buddhism as being not so smart, because they have so much pleasure, so delightful up there. It's better to be a human than a god. And so, in this particular occasion, the gods beat the Asuras. And they captured the king of the Asuras. And his name is Vepachitti. And they put him to jail. I guess I don't know what kind of jail the gods have. But and so Shakya, the king of the gods, went to visit the king of the Asuras. And Vepachitti, the king of the Asuras, threw verbal abuse upon Shakya. Angry, and was rude to him, called him names, just kind of let him have it. And Shakya remained kind, gentle, and unactivated by the abuse he was receiving. And Shakya's attendant said, when they left, said, people are going to think that you're kind of weak and a pushover. The fact that you kind of didn't return the same in kind. You didn't counter it. You should have, you know. He was abusing you. You should have stopped it. After all, he's in jail. You should have just like, you know, punished him or something. And this is what Shakya said. It is neither through fear nor weakness that I am patient with vipacitti. How can a wise person like me engage in combat with a fool? Of goals that culminate in one's own good, none is found better than patience. One who repays an angry person with anger thereby makes things worse for oneself. Not repaying an angry person with anger, one wins a battle hard to win. For someone who does not repay anger with anger practices for the welfare of both, for one's own welfare and the welfare of the others. When, knowing that one's foe is angry, one mindfully maintains one's peace. When one achieves the cure of both, his own and the others, the people who consider him a fool are unskilled in the Dhamma, in the Dharma. So the idea that not to return anger with anger. You win a battle, hard to win if you do that. So there are times when it's completely appropriate to restrain, to hold back, not give in. And that's part of patience. Sometimes we have to endure. Now's my time to endure. I'm not going to look pretty. I'm not going to be floating on a samadhi cloud of bliss. But this is not the time for it. Now is my time just to endure, to stay with it, stay present, stay with it. Don't escape it, just be. If you are free only when you're comfortable, you're not really free. We also have to learn how to be free in uncomfortable situations, including karmically uncomfortable situations. And part of the training to become free is to learn how to be with uncomfortable situations, whether it's a pain in your knee or whether it's anything, and learn to find freedom there rather than needing to change the world to find your freedom. So this the practice of restraint and this kind of patience is part of it. The second kind of patience is the patience of the second training, samadhi, the mental development, that we have the capacity to develop ourselves, to grow. I think that Buddhism has a kind of a developmental model of human growth. Just like the child psychologists now have a developmental model for children. They grow developmentally slowly over time. It's expected that that's what happens. And there's no reason why that has to stop when you turn 18 or 21 or 25 or 36 or whenever it was you became an adult. It continues into our adulthood. And so the growth of inner qualities like the six paramitas is something that develops through the practice. We develop a greater capacity for integrity. We develop a greater capacity for generosity and also for patience, but not a patience that is hard work, the hard work of restraint, but rather the patience that is the easy work of letting go. And to make that transition from the hard work of holding back to the easy work of letting go is a very important transition in this movement. So you still might feel like you want to get angry with someone, but rather than holding your tongue in check, you learn, okay, I don't need to do this. I'll relax. let go. I don't need to do this. This is not the wise thing right now. To cultivate ourselves internally so that there's inner strength and inner well-being. Part of the function of the mental development, the inner development in Buddhism, is to have an internal sense of well-being that's a reference point that helps us to realize that there are better things to do than get all worked up and get angry or be greedy. So we sit and slowly we begin to appreciate something that feels right, something feels good about just being, just sitting here, breathing. We begin letting go of the agitation. Slowly, slowly, we endure the fear we have, the anxiety, until it comes a point maybe we can let go of the fear or let it dissolve. And it's replaced with a sense of being at ease. And whatever feelings of well-being you have becomes a reference point because it highlights what it's like to lose that. If you get calm and settled, the value of the calm, one of the values of it, is that it helps you see when you lose your calm. It's kind of like, you know, if you take a white cloth that's all stained everywhere, and you put one more stain in it, you don't notice the stain. It has no meaning, this one more stain. But if the cloth is completely clean, one stain, one drop, and it stands out, and you realize it. So as we get settled, as we develop ourselves, as samadhi gets stronger, we have a reference point, we have a purity or a cleansiness or a simplicity of being that we start seeing more clearly what actually we do. And then we can learn to relate to it in a different way. We don't have to be so much work to restrain, but we see it clearly and we can let go. The muscle of letting go is such a good thing to do. So then the final training is a training in wisdom. And the great thing about wisdom, when you have it, there's a lot of different kinds of wisdom, a lot of insights you can have. But one of the really great things is that with the right kind of wisdom, really understanding and seeing, you don't have to let go. Letting go is a great capacity, great thing to learn. On this journey, but it's overrated because it kind of means you have to get rid of something. There's another kind of freedom that comes from letting things be but not buying into them, letting it be but not being entangled with it, being very simple with it. So I'd like to offer you a little practice. Some of you might want to try. So whatever it is you're noticing that's happening here in the retreat, you have certain feelings, you have certain thoughts, certain sensations, certain things happen at the retreat center, and you notice that, you know, you notice this is happening. As you tell yourself this is happening, like say you're tired, end of a day, you're tired, and you notice you're tired, and you're telling yourself, I'm tired. So the practice is to add one word in front of whatever it is you're noticing, and that's the word just. It's just a tiredness. It's just a thought. It's just a feeling. Maybe we run out of food at dinner today. It's just no food. as opposed to, oh no, there's no food. Try it. It's just, I find that that simple little word creates a little freedom, little distance, little disentangling. So things can be, it's okay. I can still have those thoughts and those feelings. I let them be, but I'm not so invested and caught. The patience of wisdom is the patience that comes from understanding how things are. So, for example, understanding that this is my karmic momentum that I have to experience now. That understanding can be so useful, because then we don't have to kind of make a big story out of it. Just know this needs to be endured for now. Or the wisdom that things change. I don't know what your favorite delusion are, but one of my mind's favorite delusion is a delusion of permanence. This is going to last forever. I'm in some kind of funk. And I know it's not going to last forever, but tell that to my mind. You know, something inside of me is like, oh, I guess this is it. So hopefully you don't have the same delusion, but you're kind of over evaluating the tremendous importance of the state of the moment, and it's going to go on forever. This is it. My knee is going to hurt forever. This is it. Delusion of permanence. A piece of wisdom that can be very helpful for patience is to appreciate that things change. You come to a retreat, you're so excited. You've been wanting to go for a retreat for months. This is it. You can't wait. You're prepared, you're ready, you're primed. You're going to go far. This is like a chance of a lifetime. Boy, enlightenment maybe, or maybe not quite that. You're not supposed to be so, have expectation, but this is it. This is a good thing. So then you come, and then you run into the first day. Feels more like it ran into you. And he's like, what did I do? What was I thinking? This is, I don't know if I can do this. Maybe I wasn't ready. And why did I come here? I could have gone to the beach and spent, you know, Santa Cruz right here. You can surf here. Why did I come here? You know, like, oh, this is so hard. And like, I'll never make it. I'll never get anywhere with this. And then second day, the tiredness fades, and maybe, you know, you settle, you start getting calm and quiet, little bit, little hints of it. Oh, this is nice. Oh, this is good. My friends need to do this. I should tell them, this is great, this is really good. But then the third day, the knees are yelling. You can't believe how much the knees hurt, or the back, or something. And like this, I guess this is it. Like, I should go home. Some retreat centers, they turn in the keys, or they park someone's car behind yours. And I've had people tell me if I only stayed because someone's car was blocking mine. So that's we're up to the third day now. And then the fourth day, the knees kind of ache still, but they're not really troubling anymore. And now there's just all this peace, quiet and still. I can't believe how still it is here. Peaceful. Wow. This is like the best. This is wonderful. I'll never be depressed ever again. But then comes the fifth day. And then comes the sixth day. So if you do this enough times, come on enough retreats, at some point, you get the wisdom of impermanence. And you appreciate that you go through cycles on retreat, through these phases and ups and downs. And this is just the tiredness of the tiredness of the first day. This is just settling in of the second day, if that's what it is. This is just the knee pain of the third day. This is just, and so you say, oh, and this will change. And slowly what we can learn, the wisdom we can learn, is to be gracious with all the changes. We cannot get so entangled with it. We can kind of ride the waves of it. And what I'm looking for as a teacher, what I'm trying to support people with, is not to have any particular experience. All experiences are overrated. Some are underrated, but in terms of great Buddhist things, experiences, they're overrated. The point is not to have an experience. The point is to be free. The point is to be fluid and easeful in being able to ride the transitions and the change of the different states of experiences we can have. And so if you do enough of these retreats, then sooner or later some wisdom begins to seep in. Oh, I know this. It's going to change. This will change. And now is the time to just be patient with this. Now is the time to just be with this, this way, and not to make a big story of it, not fall into the delusion of permanence. And then there's the wisdom of not taking things personally. It's one of the great insights of Buddhism, is the insight that you don't have to take things personally. You don't, which means you don't have to define yourself by anything. You don't have to have any definition whatsoever. You don't have to use anything at all to represent who you are to yourself. And some people protest. So, yes, but I am that. I am that. You're a lot of things. You're crowded with all kinds of people in there. You're a lot of things, but you don't have to define yourself by any of it. You can sit here and be present, be awake, be here. And you don't have to make any definition of self. I am a good meditator, I'm a bad meditator. I'm this kind of person, I'm that kind of person. And there's insight and wisdom that doesn't take anything personally. Of course, some of those things is happening to you, but even what happens to you, you don't have to take personally. One of the great pieces of advice that I received from my father, when I was about 13 or 14, he took me aside, and he said to me, Gil, as you grow up, from time to time, you're going to have some really bizarre thoughts. And, just know they're going to happen. It's normal. Don't have to make a big deal out of it. Guess what? From time to time, I had bizarre thoughts. Wasn't that a great advice? So I didn't take it so personally. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe that I'm thinking that. What a terrible person what I am, or what a great person I am. Just, oh, that's a bunch. Do we identify with our thoughts? Some people think, or some people think they are their thoughts. That's where their identification is. Some people think they are their feelings, their emotions. Some people think they are their body. And some people think they are all those things. Some people think they are their consciousness. It's not necessary to think anything about who you are. You don't have to be involved in any conception, conceiving, this is who I am. It's such a relief just to be. And so that gives a tremendous amount of patience, because that's the patience of no patience, because it's not a patience of doing anything at all. It's a patience of not having any buttons pushed. not have anything that the circumstances of life come to you and you just go right through. They don't land anywhere. If I need to be, I don't know what, the perfect meditator, and then you see me falling asleep here, which I have, meditating, but that's not being a perfect meditator, right? So I have this, here I am, the perfect meditator, and here's you seeing me sleeping. It hits, right? And that hurts. But if I don't need to be the perfect meditator, and you see me sleeping in meditation, your sight, your thoughts, whatever, they don't hit anything, right? There's nothing there to hit. But as soon as I become the perfect meditator, you know, so you kind of understand what I'm saying? So don't take it personally. Don't build up a self. Don't need to be a self, but you can get to be yourself. You get to be yourself better if you're not a self. Remember that? And you have to be yourself. That's kind of the, you have to be who you are. Probably who you are is a gift to the world. Your way of being a gift. So in different circumstances, patience looks differently. And so as you go through the retreat, there might be some circumstances where the best form of patience is restraint. It takes a lot of work. You might have to break into a sweat even, not to give in to something that's harmful. Other times, patience comes from having an inner strength and being strong, having such a well-being, calm, concentration. You develop yourself and trying things happen, difficult things happen around you that normally would trigger you, but they don't because you have the strength. You know, if a fly lands on an ant, it's a big deal for the ant. But if a fly lands on an elephant, probably the elephant doesn't even notice. Do you want to go through the world like an ant or like an elephant? So you develop your inner life, the samadhi part, and you become more like the elephant. It's okay, all these things happen. It's not a big deal. And then there's sometimes the wisdom factor predominates and your patience is informed by wisdom. And then if your wisdom, then you realize you're neither an ant or an elephant. You're nothing. Or at least you're not defining yourself by anything. And because you're not defining yourself by anything, there's a lot more ease in the world, a lot more freedom. Wherever you're at is the right place for you. Wherever you are in your practice is the right place for you. There's no mistakes in this practice. There's just the next moment, the next Dharma door for you to meet. Because wherever you're at, awakening beckons you. Come be free. You can be free with this. And it's worth it. So, let's take a couple of minutes to collect ourselves.